should be going.
Okay.
Let's see. This this survey is the same organization. It's this Virginians for American, mm-hmm. America First is promoting this survey. And unlike last time, though, I think they were hoping to get folks to meet with all of their local registrars. I think mm-hmm. the goal now is 22 or something like that. They want to just kind of get a representative sampling mm-hmm. and so forth. So
how many have they gotten to so far?
I don't know. Yeah, we met about a month ago with your cohort over in the county.
Oh, Lisa.
Yes,
yeah.
Lisa. And but I don't know how many in total that they have done.
How many did they do last year? You know?
I don't know how many they actually got to. Yeah. 60 or 70, something okay. like that, maybe.
That's not bad.
I don't know how many altogether.
132.
So,
Not bad.
Let's see. I'll just go through these questions again. So
sure.
Is this your first interview? We just talked about that. No. Your biggest concern about the upcoming election?
Implementation of some of the new laws, mm-hmm. probably. Probably the one that, you know, we're working the most on to try and figure out how to implement will be the same day registration, how that exactly will work.
Oh, yeah.
That's something that I think all localities are kind of working on exactly what that'll look like, because it will require more staffing for us the day after the election for sure, because we assume being a college town that we're likely to get a fair amount
yeah.
of those is what we're guessing. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't have 1,000 provisional votes.
Okay, so that's how they'll handle it. People register their vote, but they'll all be provisional.
Yeah, it'll be handled provisionally. So essentially what they'll do is they'll have to fill out a voter registration form, and then they'll be given a ballot, and they'll fill it out. And this happens after the close of books. So if they show up before the close of books, then we'll, you know, for early voting, we'll have them register to vote normally
yeah.
and do it that way. But if they come after the books close, and of course we'll check the movers rules to see if they're just eligible to vote anyway, because, you know, if they're you know, moved within Harrisonburg, within their precincts, they might still just be eligible to vote normally that day.
Mm-hmm.
But if movers rules don't apply to them, then yeah, we'd have them fill out a voter registration form, and then they'd vote provisionally. And then from there, the process is going into the state system and adding their information to you know, doing verification check to make sure there isn't any sort of thing on, you know, in the system that says that they're a felon or
yeah.
you know, deceased or
register someplace else.
Well, in the state, you know, outside of the state,
unfortunately,
our system doesn't work with other states. That's a process. We eventually do get that information through the ERIC network, but it can take up to a year sometimes to get that back. So, and that's just the nature of, you know, working within that system. And that's not even, unfortunately, it's not even all states. I think it's only 35 states that are a member of ERIC. And there's a bunch of other states that just either don't want to join for whatever reason or have their own system that they prefer. But yeah, we would do, you know, do a check on them to make sure there is any sort of thing that would preclude them from being a voter in Virginia. And then it would still work the same provisional process at that point. The electoral board would have to have their provisional ballot hearing. We'd give our recommendation. Then we'd go through the rest of the canvas. And at the end of the canvas, then they would go through and count the provisional votes as long as nothing's changed
yeah.
in between when I gave my recommendation and the day. They actually count them, and that'll be the more work part is because we assume the majority of them are going to happen on election day.
Yeah.
I can't imagine I'll get many during early voting, and those we can kind of work on as we're moving along.
Yeah,
so the early vote, you know, the election day is going to be the majority of them, and you know, we have to have that provisional ballot hearing. I think we have to have it the day after. I don't remember what the law says exactly. Typically, you have it by noon. We might be able to have it later. We've got to have I have to give a recommendation to the electoral board on how we consider this. Is this something that's just an outright, there's no way this can count?
Yeah.
Is it possible they can count? Am I recommending that it can count? And so I have to be able to come up with some sort of recommendation. So that means I'm going to have to look through all, I don't have to process them, but I at least have to run a check on each one of these before they can have that hearing. Now, that's probably unlikely that I'll be able to do that. So more what'll be something that in talking with other registrars and Department of Elections, what we'll have to do is the recommendation we get the electoral board, we'll have to say, this is a preliminary recommendation, and my recommendation I give you today may completely change by the time
yeah.
you actually count it. So it'll definitely, it'll create some more work for us the day after, for sure. It's gonna add some more to our workload. We'll have to make sure we've got enough staff and enough bodies to throw at it the day after, depending on how many we get. And it's also just going to be an education piece. We want to make sure that, because like I said, I assume it's going to be, most of it's going to be students in Harrisonburg.
Yeah.
But they understand that, yes, the system exists. You can use this method, but it should be plan B.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be your, this is how you're going to vote this year. You should register normally and get it in before the deadline rather than just think, oh, well, I can
do it all
that day. So that'll, you know, we're going to do our best with educating with the groups that are working on campus with students. But, you know, of course, you can only get so many people to listen.
Yeah.
And you can only get the information to as many people as you can. So we're assuming, yeah, that we're going to have a large amount of those.
Well, I thought last time we talked, when there was a similar question, and I think at the time you'd said, you know, just trying to keep track of all the with students, the addresses, and who still's here and who isn't here. And it just made me think your colleagues that are in university towns have a special set of circumstances track all this temporary residents, basically.
You know, we'll have these voters that are here for 4 to 5, 6 years, and they might be at a different address every year.
Yeah.
Now, granted, not all of them change their address like they're supposed to, and some of it, you know, as long as they're within the precinct or within Harrisonburg Movers Rules account, so they're still able to vote in that, doing that. But it can be a lot of address changes. You know, it's interesting when I talk to registrars, and I recently talked to the registrar over in Culpeper, and it was just interesting hearing about how many registrations for updates he gets compared to us.
Yeah.
And it's a huge difference in how many registrations he gets in election. Compared to us, where there's days like last year where we're getting over 100 paper applications a week, sometimes 200-300 in 1 week, and that's on top of everything else we're getting digitally or in the mail. These are just paper applications that are being brought in that we've got to process. So it could be a lot.
And JMU students is the lion's share of that.
Yeah, majority is JMU students, EMU students some too, and a little bit of everyone. But yeah, majority of it's going to be JMU students. Mm-hmm.
I remember I was a little surprised when we talked to Lisa a month ago. I had always remembered your answer about students, and she hadn't mentioned anything about students in the course of us talking. And when we did bring it up, does the whole student issue bring up? She said, "We don't really have that many students in the county," which is funny because you'd think they would be scattered.
There've been a couple apartment complexes in the county, but not much.
Most are in the city.
Well, she's got Bridgewater College too, but it's still, again, it's like the size of EMU, which is a small drop in the bucket here in Harrisonburg when I'm dealing college registrations compared to JMU.
Yeah.
When you've got I think they're around 23,000. Students or something like that, and all 23,000, could be, it's not, but it's feasible to think all 23,000 could be eligible to register to vote here. That's each year, and so that's the interesting thing that'll happen with that JMU precinct is that it's hard to forecast ballot orders and things like that, because right now the JMU precinct, I want to say it's around 1,200 to 1,300 that are registered to vote at the JMU precinct. We've had less when we started before fall, and that number could go up to 3,000 before we get to November, because most of the students, of course, aren't updating their registration until October, when they're really thinking about it, or the campaigns are actually making their way to students, or they're hearing about elections and things like that. So the number for students can really fluctuate, so it's hard to look at that right now and think the number of registered voters we have on campus now could double by election day. And so I kind of have to always keep that in the back of my head, especially when we've got, this year with a local election, we've got city council, school board, you've got, campaigners on the ground that will actually be working here, where like last year, the governor's race, they're active, but they're not, the candidates aren't here every day as active as a city council or school board candidate might be.
Interesting. Question two was just any other major concerns. We touched on a lot of things in that first one, but let's see. Number four, do you feel like you have the resources, equipment, personnel, and training needed to run an effective election in November?
Equipment, yes. Training, yes. You know, we could always use more resources and personnel. Yeah. I never want to say we're adequate there because, you know, if I had, you know, a blank check, I would definitely have a lot more for us. But we work with, you know, what we have and, you know, what's reasonable. Mm-hmm. But I feel like for this election, we have, I wouldn't say that we're in a detriment or we don't have enough. We can pull everything we need to do with the resources and personnel we have, but I would always want more. I'm still trying to work to get a full-time staff member in my office is the thing that I'm mm-hmm. I'm really working towards. Because right now I'm the only full-time staff member in my office. Now that doesn't mean my part-time staff isn't here a lot more during election season, but that's something we're long-term goal we're working towards.
Ultimately, who decides the staffing level and budgets for the payroll? And is it the city council or is the state involved at all?
That's a kind of a hard question to answer. Majority of it is yes, is decided by city council. Now there are recommendations that come from the state and there's recommendations that come from the electoral board, but in the end it is the locality that mm-hmm. does have to, you know, that they pay for my staff. Mm-hmm. The only thing the state pays for is my salary and the electoral board. Oh. Everything else elections wise has to be paid by the locality. Now they can get funding from the state for certain things, but the majority of it has to be paid through by the locality funds.
Question five is, do you have adequate number of precinct staff that meet the requirements of having equally declared Republicans and Democrats?
The way this question is asked, mm-hmm. no, yep. I do not. Because we just do not have enough Republican officers of election. We had a lot of people sign up last year. So when we talked last year, I felt a lot better about it because we'd had a lot of new Republican officers that signed up. And so many people, just when they realized how long the day was going to be, some of the other requirements, we had a lot of people drop on us last year. And we just did not have enough Republican officers that could work for us that day or even this past primary. In my mind, I would have preferred to just have all the precinct staffed by nothing but Republicans, but we don't have enough Republican officers to do that. So we're desperately in need of more Republican officers of election. It's a tough thing because it election day, it's a long day. Yeah. It's a very long day and it can be a lot to ask for people. And I understand that, but we're just definitely in need of more Republican officers of election.
I'm one of the ones that ditched on you last year.
I did not know that until you said that. So,
no, that's okay. I'll own up to it. A bunch of Navy buddies scheduled a trip and
things happen
for November. But I'll at the end. I have some questions, and I think I'll turn this. If it's not too late, I think I'll turn this in today for the next upcoming.
Yeah, absolutely, please.
Let's see. And there's a little follow-up on five. It says, if you don't have adequate number of representatives for both, how do you try or how do you plan to ensure that there is party equity in poll staffing? What kind of workarounds, I guess, do you do?
We do the best we can with it. You know, I think we do a pretty good job of making, you know, we make sure when, you know, even though we have a limited number of Republican officers compared to Democrat and Independent, we always try to make sure that we have a sizable number of Republican officers. We try not mm-hmm. to have a situation where, you know, we only have one Republican here and five over here. We try to make sure that we've, and that tends to, again, be a difficulty because people want to work at the precinct they want to work at, and we have to tell them, I'm sorry, I'm going to send you to Thomas Harrison because we only have one Republican over there. They don't always love that they're going to have to work a precinct that they don't know with people they don't know. So that's another challenge. Sometimes you have to work around. So yeah, we try and move people around so that we have representation. Trying to make sure that we, you know, have a chief and a Republican and Democratic chief and assistant chief there at each precinct like I said, it's still something that's it's been a challenge for sure.
Can I ask a follow-up on that? Has anybody ever proposed, I'll throw out just some numbers, for example, has anybody proposed anything like this? Let's say you need 25 election officers, mm-hmm. and you've got 10 Republicans, you've got 15 Democrats, mm-hmm. and you've got independents, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Has anybody ever proposed, say, well, we'll take the 10 Republicans, we'll take the 10 Democrats, we'll make up the balance with the independents?
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by...
In other words, you've got an excess of Democrat election mm-hmm. workers, but you've got... You need 25, you've got 10 Republicans, you've got 15 Democrats, but your office would say, well, we'll take the 10 Republicans, we'll take 10 of the 15 Democrats, and then we'll make up the other 5 out of people who've declared as independent.
I guess I'm still trying to work around what would be the purpose of doing
that. I guess, in theory, you've only got two, you've got a balanced number of really partisan people.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And then the difference is made up by folks put down as independent.
Well, I'll be completely honest with you about it. When we're working on scheduling our officers, we do work on trying to make sure we have enough representation from both parties. But honestly, a lot of times the more important thing is that we have people that know what they're doing, have experience. And sometimes we have, somebody that's been doing this for 10 years, we have to have them at that precinct. And so that sometimes will be the deciding factor is this group of independents we have they ever done this before?
Yeah.
We try to limit the number of newbies in a place. We don't want to have 5 people that have never done this before that are kind of the majority in one precinct with only 3 people.
Yeah.
So sometimes that kind of has to rule out the day is who's got the most experience, who's done these jobs before, and then we go to making sure that we're, doing as much as we can for party parity. But the experience is definitely a more important thing that we have to make sure that we have to get that taken care of, because we just don't want to put our chiefs in a situation where they've got a whole field of, green team that doesn't know what they're doing.
And that's certainly, as I've talked to more people who've done this, some just a few times, others many, they said usually the first few times it's very basic things that you do. You wouldn't be nowhere near ready to run the show at a precinct or anything like that.
Yeah, so typically the first couple elections, it would be someone was helping people getting their ballots in the machine, getting their stickers, managing the place where people actually vote and directing them to the voting booths, helping with like curbside voting. Yeah, usually when we move someone up to like, they're doing like the poll book or issuing ballots, they've usually worked for us a couple times, unless it's someone that's showing like a, someone that's, I worked in IT for years, someone that's got a special aptitude towards that work that we might move up to that. But we've never had a situation where someone that's never done it before is a chief. That can't happen. If they're going to be a chief, they've had to work a few times for us or had some sort of background that'd be relevant to that work. But I don't think it's basically a rule with my electoral board is that whoever's a chief can't be their first time working, no matter what their skills are. They've had to have at least worked for us a few times before we move them to a chief, assistant chief position.
Number 6 was, did each precinct in your county or city have partisan observers for that last election? And then it's in parentheses, primary and general. So I guess they're talking about this most recent one and then the November election last year.
Are we saying for like the whole day or just that they came?
Well, I think I'm getting that somebody showed up at all, during the period of time.
Yeah, from my memory, I can't remember as far back as November. It almost seems like a lifetime ago. I want to say probably, but I don't know. But for the primary, we had observers show up for at least even the JMU precinct where we only had one voter. We had an observer
one
come
voter?
Out. We had one voter at the JMU precinct. Gosh. So we really got to kick the tires on the new precinct with that one voter. We only had 3 officers there, but they, they had to... Oof. Waited out the whole day for that one voter. But they did have an observer come in and sat there, I think, for about an hour or two and decided that it wasn't the best use of their wasn't the best use of their time. So
Number 7 was, does the county health department send a list of deceased people to your office every the question says month, but I presume that's been changed to, it's supposed to be weekly now.
So that actually doesn't come from a county, that comes from the Office of Vital Statistics, which is a state organization. So the new law changed, they send that to us weekly. Before they had been sending it to us monthly, and so now we get that weekly.
Has that been of assistance to you, or just...
Somewhat. I mean, the difficult part that I have now with it is that, I'm always just a little wary of just processing those outright. I know some of my colleagues might just process them and move on. But I like to, we go check, we look for obituaries, we look for death notices, things like that, just to make sure That there wasn't some mistake somewhere, because, you know, these things can happen. And with it coming so quickly now, we're getting them before an obituary or death notice can show up in the newspaper. So there's not a lot of things that we can go by to check on. Like I said, what we're doing, we're probably going above and beyond what we need to, so it's not necessary. But I just feel better knowing that, like, okay, there's an obituary, there's a death notice, so we can be, you know, rest assured that this, you know, this person is deceased at that point. But so that's the only thing that I'd say that's maybe... you know, created a small challenge for us, but it's nothing that, you know, sometimes we'll just have to maybe wait a little bit longer, or if we feel pretty confident about it, we'll just go ahead and process it as is when it comes from the vital records department.
I think I remember Lisa saying that they hadn't received lists even monthly for the longest time, and her office had just been monitoring obituaries for years and years, so.
Yeah. I'll do that too. I definitely go and look through the obituaries, but I typically don't feel comfortable processing it until I get the record from the state. The thing we do, what I, the difficulty that you run into sometimes with the deceased is, someone dies within Virginia, system works pretty well. You'll get, you know, I'll be able to see a death notice, I'll see an obituary, we'll get something from the Office of Vital Records. They die out of state. If there's someone that's registered in Virginia, but they just happen to be wherever, out of the country, out of the state, that can take a year sometimes. Because, again, we have to work through the ERIC network. Now, sometimes it might take quicker. So that might be the reason you want to check for your obituaries and your death notices for someone that passed away outside of the state. Because that, like I said, we're communicating between states is not the quickest thing. And sometimes that can take a while to get that information back from other states. So I would say that would be the reason you might want to check obituaries and death notices for those that have passed. Of course, that's not a super common thing. I mean, typically, if someone's, you know, registered here, you know, they've gone out of state, they're probably going to register to that other state, you know. So, I mean, not saying that it doesn't happen, but it's not the most common thing either.
And question number 8 sort of plays into that. What do you do when if a relative notifies you that a family member is deceased and needs to be dropped from the voter rolls?
So if they bring in the death certificate, if they have the death certificate, then we can just process it as is at that point. Okay. So sometimes we might ask them to send us a copy of the death certificate. There's also a form. There's another form. So that would be for like a direct family member, you know, that would have access to something like that. For someone that's maybe like the cousin or, you know, a step, you know, someone that's not direct family, there is a form that they can fill out, or a neighbor or a friend or that can notify us we'll investigate. Now we can't delete someone or, you know, mark them as deceased based on that form, but that will allow us to investigate and then send a query, you know, to the state to see if they can check for us. So there's those two options. Like I said, direct family members, if we haven't got anything from the vital records, we'd ask that they send us the death certificate, or there's the form that other friends and extended family can fill out.
Okay.
And we typically have those at the polls on election day that people can take with them too.
Oh. 9 is, during the last election cycle, did you have complaints from voters that someone had voted in their name? For instance, was a mail-in ballot received and the voter claimed that they did not cast the mail-in vote? And were there any already voted scenarios? But people that showed up and were told that they'd already voted scenarios.
I'm trying to think if we had any of those this past election. I don't think so. Not that I remember. We had one in the November election, but that was the standard thing that typically the two times I've seen these, it's because it's a father being checked in as a son or a family member with a similar name being checked in. And that's typically what those been, the handful of those I've had, which I think less than 5, it's usually a family member or someone with a very similar name, getting checked in as someone else by mistake. But I don't remember having any in the primary that I remember. We also didn't, there wasn't a lot of mailed ballots for the primary either. So it was a small number of ballots we mailed.
Do your absentee voter drop boxes have video monitoring that is monitored 24/7? If so, who's reviewing the video to ensure there are no issues, or how is that done?
So we do not have an exterior drop box for absentee ballots.
Okay.
So So if someone wants to return their absentee ballot in person, they have to do it during office hours when we're here, uh-huh. or on election day to a polling location, or of course, you know, they can mail it. But we don't know. We do not have a drop box here in the city.
Okay. I wonder if 11 becomes moot. Are all drop boxes emptied with the witness? Yeah.
Yeah, that would be
all right. We'll jump to 12. Did the party chairman of both parties get invited to calibrate their machines during the last election?
No, because we wouldn't invite the Democratic chair to the Republican primary machine calibration.
That's right.
What about last November?
Yes.
So yes, and last November was, yeah.
Yes, in November. No, in the primary, but because, for good reason.
Can you, the little subset says, did they accept and attend? Did the Republican person come in this go-round? And
yeah.
Did both come before it? Can you recall?
Pat Hayden's definitely come the last, since she's been chair, she's been to every time we've done a test. She's been there. I don't think there's been anybody that's represented the Democrats the last two times, though, that I remember. There might have been, the chair didn't come, but there might have been an observer in November that came for a little bit, but Pat was definitely here in November and for the whole thing, not for November, I mean for the fall election and for the primary.
Question 13 gets into, how are your voting machines stored and secured between elections?
So they're secured in a locked room here in City Hall that we keep under lock and key. There's a log that has to be filled out anytime anyone accesses that room, saying who it was, when they accessed it, and the time, and how long they were in there. And the only people that are allowed to access it would be me and my staff, the electoral board members, and our technicians that work on the machines, and then of course any technicians that we have from one of our vendors, but typically they're going to access it with me or someone from staff there observing them while they do that.
So for the who has access to, is you and your staff?
Staff, certain officers of election, like our technicians, they're called custodians, technician custodians, and then the electoral board.
And you said there were logs when you go in there?
Yeah, the log is actually on the door.
Okay.
So it's out there in public on the side of the door.
Okay.
And then once we, you know, fill a sheet, it's, you know, logged in the minutes for the electoral board, and they, I think those are kept in perpetuity. I don't know. You'd have to ask Jane how long those are kept.
All right. A question came up last time we talked about, when we did the interviews before, when they say voting machines, we weren't certain, and maybe we forgot to ask Lisa, but
sure.
Is the machine, is the box with the, where you can put the ballots in if the machine is not functioning temporarily, does the box stay at the precinct things and the machine is just something sits on top? Because she said people come and pick up the machines, and we wondered, you know, what if you don't get, what can, you can't fit it in the trunk of a car?
Yeah, she does it a little bit differently than we do. I mean, I don't want to speak for Lisa. But no, for ours, it's the bottom part that the ballots are stored in and the machine are all connected.
So
we don't store anything offside.
It looked like one unit, you know.
With Lisa, she said that
hers is like
the machine is, you know, the smaller piece, and then so the two different pieces.
That is easily carried, and the box might stay at the precinct or something. Just
that sounds right, but again, I wouldn't want to speak for her.
So yours is all one.
Yeah, I mean, we only have the 8 precincts, so typically.
So you all deliver those around.
Yeah, so public works, so the electoral board and members of public works will go out the day before election and physically deliver them to the precincts. And then the precincts that are completely can be put under our lock and key will keep the machines out. There's a couple precincts where they're in rooms that might be duly accessible, like Thomas Harrison, I think, is one, and Smithland, where we lock them in a closet the night before, since it's, you know, you can't lock the cafeteria completely down. There's too many doors. But the rest of them, where the gymnasiums, we can completely lock those down, so we'll store them.
Secure voting area. And so 15 is the that delivers the voting machines. That's public. That's city public works folks, right?
So yeah, that'd be electoral board and public works.
Okay. Who delivers the actual physical ballots, I guess, to the voting precinct, and what is the procedure?
That'd be the electoral board.
Okay.
And there's a chain of custody form that has to be filled out each time they take ballots.
Okay. Chain of custody. Do they bring them like early in the morning of, or?
I don't think I can go too far into that. Might be a security thing. I don't know if I can go into how they, the process they use beforehand, chain of custody use, and its electoral board, making sure they have ballots there beforehand. But throughout the day, they're the only ones that are bringing ballots if they need more ballots throughout the day.
Okay. 17 is, does your city utilize touchscreen voting or paper ballots?
Well, we use paper ballots, of course, but we do have the touchscreen for our ADA machine.
Yeah.
So, but that also, that's, it uses a paper ballot, so it's a touchscreen to print out.
But then it spits out a paper when it gets scanned.
Exactly, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm not sure that you can, in Virginia, use solely just a touchscreen that doesn't have a paper ballot anymore.
Okay.
I think that was, I think the law was changed maybe 2012 or 13 that said you had to have a paper ballot at the end of it.
18 is when the post-election day canvass is conducted, and there are discrepancies, are there counts of ballots themselves or just a reading of the computer-generated report?
Okay, let me read this again. When the post-election day canvass is conducted, are there any discrepancies? Are there, and there are discrepancies. Oh, okay, so it's asking if there's discrepancies in the numbers that we have, do we go back and count the ballots? Well, it depends on what sort of discrepancy we're talking about, I guess, would be the issue. But typically, I've never had a discrepancy so large that necessitate anything like that. Usually, honestly, where our discrepancies have popped up has usually been in the undervotes or overvotes or something like that at the end, which doesn't affect the outcome of the election. So usually we've had to go back and edit those. There might have been, I think in 2020, there was, I think, one of the Commissioner of Revenue precincts, we had to change a 6 to a 0, I think. A lot of that would kind of be determined by the Electoral Board if there was a substantial change between what we reported initially on election night and during the post-canvass that would necessitate something along those lines. But then, of course, that's why we do the canvas. You know, what we put out election night is preliminary numbers. The canvas is to go back and verify all the information that's been filled out by the chiefs and verify it against what's printed from the machines.
I guess, and educate me, because I'm not, with that question number 18, I guess what I assumed was if let's say there's that vote total, like 800 votes were cast here today,
mm-hmm.
Somehow shows 798 or something. Do they go back and actually count whether there are 798 pieces of paper or 800 pieces of paper? I guess that was what I took that question to kind of mean.
Discrepancy?
Yeah, I guess that would be the thing. I'm not sure how we would find a discrepancy like that to even, because it's going to be based on, you know, they're doing the math by how many ballots. You know, how many people were checked into the poll book?
Yeah.
So how many ballots they issued? Then you're subtracting out how many ballots were spoiled or voided.
Yeah.
And then that end number you're taking, you're comparing it against the actual machine tablets.
Well,
and how many ballots?
I guess that's what it is. So that
when
you do that calculation, if there's a different number from the poll book and the spoiled and all that, and what the machine says.
So typically, if that happens, they're going to find that out election night while they're doing the paperwork, and
mm-hmm.
what the chiefs and the assistant chiefs are supposed to do is figure out how that discrepancy happened.
Okay.
So they've got to stay there and fill out the paperwork and explain this.
Figure
this,
it out.
What happened? Go back through and figure out what transpired that created that issue, and then the next day for the canvas, when we go back through the SORs and we look for their explanation, if the explanation isn't sufficient, or if it's an explanation that doesn't, you know, exactly explain whatever that issue may be, that might necessitate something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
I've never encountered anything like that. Typically, if there is a discrepancy, it's something that can be explained, you know, under normal operating procedures, that it was, you know, like, I think we've, like, what will a lot of times happen is you'll have someone that'll check in to vote, and then they'll decide they don't want to vote, and they'll walk away. Mm-hmm. And if they get a long line and they can't remember the name of that person that checked in, there's no way to really go back and uncheck that person out. So they're checked in as having voted, even though they didn't vote a ballot. Mm-hmm. So your check-in number and your number of ballots that went through the machine are going to be different. Now, the stopgap is your number of ballots that were issued will be the same as what was gone through them that were actually used for the poll book. So as long as those numbers match up, the number of ballots that you issued are the same that was gone through the poll book, that would explain that issue, is that, okay, we think we only spoiled 3 ballots, but we actually have 4 ballots that were spoiled. That's going to be that person that got checked in that didn't end up.
And somebody walked out with the form unfilled out or whatever when they
left. A ballot? Oh, yeah. I hope not. That can't. I mean, that's okay. Our officers are trained to be looking
to
for
watch
that.
For
yeah, because ballots are not illegally. They're not. Yeah. As soon as if you take a ballot and you walk out of that room with it, that's a misdemeanor. As soon as you step over the threshold, that's so. Now, yeah, right. If it's, but our officers do watch for that. You know, to make sure that isn't happening. Now, I mean, could someone fold it up and stick it, you know, sure. Yes, that's not impossible, but I'm not sure.
But I guess
I'm not sure to what end, you know, what would be the point. And it'll be even with the new laws, things like that, you know, the concern in the past would have been, you know, someone has a nefarious intent and for one vote, again, I'm not sure what would be the purpose for one vote. But anyway, if they were to do this and go to and vote at a different precinct in Harrisonburg, right? And so they've gone somewhere else. The new law that requires us to report by precinct. So now for early voting, we're going to be required to report, to break down all the early voting numbers that we get from out here. We'll have to say how many are allocated to each precinct. So the technical way to do that, the only way we can do that is that the ballots will be coded to precincts. So when people come in for early voting here, we will be issuing them a specific ballot for the precinct they're supposed to vote at. So you vote at 101 Sims, here's the 101 Sims ballot. Now they're all gonna look the same. They're not gonna have anything different on them, but they're all gonna be coded for each precinct. Because we have to do that for early voting, you can't go from coding them one way for early voting and coding them a different way for election day. So on election day, same thing. All the ballots will be coded for each precinct. So if you tried to take a Sims ballot and walk over to Waterman with it, the machine would not accept it. It couldn't read it that day.
Okay.
So that will, you know, by necessity of these new changes, it will add that layer of security. But again, I'm not sure if someone were to go to that grand...
it's not hundreds of people.
I'm not sure what they would be accomplishing by doing that.
I'm just thinking, the person would have, you know, got some walks in and forget. Like we all do walk through and forget why they're there and they walk out. I'm sure that's happened somewhere.
Well, hopefully they're holding the ballot in their hand and we'll see that and turn them around and aim them towards a desk and a pen before they leave.
Let's see. Number 19, House Bill 150 that went into effect 1 July 2022 requires that public body meetings, such as the electoral board meetings, to be posted on an official government website within 7 days of the final approval of minutes. This is in addition to existing requirements that meeting dates, times, and locations must also be posted in advance. How is your office meeting this requirement?
And by following the letter of law. So that would mean after approval, so that's going to mean we will be posting the minutes for the previous, not the meeting that just happened, the previous meeting that they approve.
Because they have to approve the minutes.
Right, they have to approve them at their next meeting. But we've been doing, I mean, we post the minutes sooner than 7 days after most of our meetings. So and we're typically posting draft minutes in advance, too. Now, not always. When we're having more meetings, a little bit busier, we may not always be able to post the draft minutes. Of course, that's not required, but we typically strive to do that.
So post draft minutes voluntarily.
But yeah, the rest of that, we'll be, we should be sticking within those parameters.
All right. And the last one here is gets to that about the death notice from the Registrar of Voter Records. Senate Bill 211 and House Bill 55, both of which went into effect on July 1st, 2022, required that the state registrar of vital records transmit a weekly list of deceased individuals, parentheses, previously this was monthly. General registrars will be required to promptly cancel the registrations of persons known to be deceased or otherwise disqualified from voting. How will your office address this new requirement, and who will be in charge making sure that the registrations are promptly canceled?
Well, I mean, ultimately it'll be me that's in charge of that, but I'll be disseminating that work between my two deputies, and so it'll be a shared duty among my deputies, Tracy Kahn and Katrina Gerald and me.
And that ends the questionnaire. Do you have any other follow-up things? Or?
No.
All right. I have just jotted a few things down. We ended up talking about it, but I remembered your answer to about the student things, and has there been any silver bullet found to try to track these addresses better? I remember after we talked, somebody said, "Oh, you might go talk to the city, blocking Chaz, city clerk or whatever, because he has to keep track of all the." Jury rolls, and who's eligible for jury duty, and he doesn't have any silver bullet either for keeping up with these students.
I smile at that question because Chaz actually gets his list from us.
So he gets.
Okay. So I would just be looking into my own well going over.
Wait, I can't remember a specific answer. He said he said it's like trying to chase your tail, but. He did say that he gets stuff in from a number of different places, and he just has to correlate.
Being
it's a
one
challenge.
Of them being us and Lisa, so yeah, it's unfortunately the colleges are limited in what they can give us too.
Yeah.
I would love it if the colleges could share more information with me about this, but they're limited in being, privacy reasons that they can only share but so much or tell me about so many things. So, a lot of it's just it behooves the student to make sure they're keeping their records up to date. But, with movers rules, as long as they are within Harrisonburg, if they are moving and staying within Harrisonburg, there's a certain amount of time where they're still eligible and within the letter of the law. It's when they move out of Harrisonburg that things become a problem. When we have students that move in, register freshman year, I'm sure there's plenty of them that aren't updating it as diligently as they should, but they're, Harrisonburg is an at-large election district, so we don't elect anyone in Harrisonburg by districts. None of our city council or school board members are elected by districts. Okay. So there's nothing that I'm not concerned in that regard, but yes, I would always prefer it if they're updating it and keeping their addresses current. But I know that's also in some ways wishful thinking.
Only other two questions I had were involved, the election officers, and the pre-voting period. I did a couple of shifts as an observer during the primary thing, and I don't have to tell you it was 5 or 6 people in half a day.
Pretty slow.
And it goes on for so long. Is there talk among registrars of maybe having it be up to 45 days outside of an election, but not necessarily every day of the week, for that. Because you can account for people that are ill for, 4 or 5 weeks and they can't make. But it just seems like such
a... non-negotiable. Okay. That's in the code. So anytime my office is open, I have to, during that 45-day period, I have to allow early voting to happen.
So that would be a legislative change.
Yeah, and I can't... my office has to be open 5 days a week for at least, 8 hours a day. So that means I have to have early voting 5 days a week, 8 hours a day.
Assuming if the numbers stayed, that was the other question, and Lisa said she does things a little differently. If the numbers stayed at, 5 to 12 a day, of early voters or something like that, I guess she said she just runs that early voting precinct out of her office.
Yeah, she does it in her office. The difficulty that I have in my office, she has a whole separated area between their workstations and where they are. I don't really have that, and so the issue is I'm required to allow observers in there. And observers are not allowed to see various information that has social security numbers, birth dates, protected information. There's nowhere for me to put an observer that'll be able to see the process, but they won't be able to see our screens.
Other things.
So that's why every time we have early voting, for now until Hopefully in the future we can get into a new space or expanded space. There's not really, I haven't found a workable solution to doing it in there. And, you know, the primary would have been, you know, for most elections, the governor's race, we had so many voters, it wouldn't have worked in that space. You know, we possibly could have run the primary in there. But again, we sat there and measured and did everything we could trying to figure out, and there just wasn't a workable solution. And just also the issue of sometimes we've got to, you got to say private information out loud to another person when they're on the phone. If you got an observer in there, that becomes a problem. So it's difficult to keep people's information private. Where Lisa has that whole wall and separation where she can have the observers there, so they can see the check-in process, they can hear the names, but they're not necessarily, you know, right there where all the privileged information is being used. So, but for right now, you know, I think having it, you know, it's not ideal, obviously, for smaller primaries. I would prefer to try and have it in the office if we could, but for things like general elections and in the fall, I think the governor's race and probably likely for this race, I think that space is
more numbers.
Adequate for that. It would be probably difficult to run an election that size out of the office, even without the observational issues we may have.
And the last thing was just, and Bunny actually told me after we spoke a month ago, that she had, I guess, that morning gone to the election board meeting, or mm-hmm. I guess that's, you can publicly attend that, and had talked about, I know one of the things that comes up a lot, and even with me, not so much, I mean, I guess if they need people during early voting period, election officers, why is it okay to split shifts during early voting, but that, you know, I think it's ridiculous. It's just one day, and goodness knows, I'm retired now as a doctor, but I've worked plenty of 16-hour days, but it just seems to be there from 5 in the morning to 8 at night. Is there any workaround, you know, to that? Because I think you'd get more people. Most of the people inclined to do this are older and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I would just throw my 2 cents in for split shifts if it ever became possible with enough people and all that.
Well, I got to answer this in a diplomatic way.
You don't have to be, I got thick skin.
Oh, no, not towards you.
Okay.
The short of it is that's not my call.
Yeah.
So that is a decision that's made by the electoral board.
So the board would have to.
Yeah, the electoral board is the kind of deciding body on the shifts. I know some
of... Do you think that would be helpful to allow split shifts as far as get more people?
You know, you're asking for my opinion on something that I don't get to be the deciding body on, so I won't necessarily answer it the way you asked, but I will say that we have found difficulty with getting people that can work an entire shift, and it has been a challenge, I know, for a lot of people to do that. I know some of the concerns that the electoral board has with going to that model is just with the accountability, with the forms that you have to fill, saying that you were there in the morning witnessing that and not having the same people there at night witnessing the same things. They're just a little concerned about that. I know that there were some other areas that they had some concern about, but it is something that we're going to be discussing at their meeting on Monday. So it's on the agenda to be discussed, is to kind of talk that out in a public meeting and see, you know, where they can land on possibly looking at that. I mean, there's some positions that can't be split shift. You can't have your chief or your system chief. You really can't have your poll book worker be doing a split shift. But I'm sure there's positions that could possibly work within that range. But I do know that the electoral board has some concerns.
Those people are busier and the time would pass more. But if you're just wiping tabletops down, that's a long time to wipe tabletops down.
Yeah,
I guess I just assume I think the first observing I ever did was during this governor's election, and you know I of course as an observer I could do my 6 hours or whatever and leave, but it I thought, oh well, they have to stay all day because it's chain of custody issues. But then when I did the pre-voting stuff, I saw that some of the election workers were doing shifts, and I said, well, it must not be that, you know, because they can have shifts during the pre-voting, the early voting.
Well, and the difference there too is that they're doing it unlike I am acting as the chief.
Oh, okay.
So I'm for all early voting, I'm accountable for all that. Where once it leaves City Hall, our chiefs and our assistant chiefs are accountable for conducting the election. So it works a little bit differently in that regard, where I will be here the first day of 45 and the last day of 45, and so will my staff and the electoral board, where I can't be in the precincts on election day. You know, I'm not there to witness and document any issues that may happen.
Very good.
Okay.
Thank you very
great.
Much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Yeah, no problem.